on the Noon Book Hour, The Street Lawyer by John Grisham. Michael Brock is billing the hours, making the money, rushing relentlessly to the top of Drake and Sweeney, a giant D.C. law firm. One step away from partnership, Michael has it all. Then in an instant, it all comes undone. A homeless man takes nine lawyers hostage in the firm's plush offices. When it's all over, the man's blood is splattered on Michael's face. And suddenly, Michael is willing to do the unthinkable. Rediscovering a conscience he lost long ago, Michael is leaving the big time for the streets where his attacker once lived and where society's powerless need an advocate for justice. But there's one break Michael can't make. From a secret that has floated up from the depths of Drake and Sweeney, from a confidential file that is now in Michael's hands, and from a conspiracy that has already taken lives. Now Michael's former partners are about to become his bitter enemies, because to them, Michael Brock is the most dangerous man on the streets. The Street Lawyer by John Grisham, weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 68 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Destination. Faster, higher, stronger. The Medalworthy U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Museum is opening in Colorado Springs. By Dana Joseph. When Dick Celeste left his position as president of Colorado College in 2012, he felt like getting involved in a new project that would elevate Colorado Springs. Previously, he'd been instrumental in the establishment of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame while governor of Ohio, and he knew all about the power of a global brand and how to get a big idea done. The project he set his sights on was the new U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Museum. I was stunned there wasn't a proper celebration of the Olympic movement here, Celeste, who now sits on the board as founding chairman, told USA Today on the occasion of the museum's groundbreaking in June 2017. While there are more than 30 Olympic museums around the world, attempts to establish a major one in the United States had never materialized. The changes this year, when the first full-fledged Olympic and Paralympic Museum in the United States opens in Colorado Springs, well, in time to celebrate on home soil during the rescheduled to 2021 Tokyo 2020 Summer Games, or any time at all. Colorado's second city is, after all, Olympic City, USA, home of both the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee and the flagship U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Training Center. It's a logical place to honor the ideals and document the history of the Olympic and Paralympic movements, and to share the impressive and inspiring stories of the nearly 13,000 U.S. Olympic and Paralympic athletes who have competed for Team USA since 1896. The 60,000 square foot museum features 13 galleries, several special events areas, a 145 seat theater, and the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Hall of Fame, which showcases inducted athletes, teams, coaches, and special contributors to the movements. As part of the immersive storytelling and programming, the museum displays a considerable and growing collection of artifacts ranging from the monumental to the mundane, from Bonnie Blair's speed skates to Shannon Miller's scrunchie. Athletes are constantly sending us artifacts and memorabilia from their games experience, says Director of Marketing and Communications Tommy Shield. Nearly every day we get to work, it feels like Christmas. One of the best things on view is the Miracle on Ice scoreboard from the hockey match at the 1980 Lake Placid Olympic Winter Games that memorably saw the young underdog U.S. team, coached by Herb Brooks, come from behind to defeat the monolithic Soviets and ultimately take the gold. Vying with the scoreboard for most impactful and evocative is the impressive collection of Olympic torches, including one like the torch memorably carried by Muhammad Ali, who lit the Olympic cauldron during the opening ceremony at the 1996 Games in Atlanta. The design and construction team, led by the award-winning New York architecture firm Diller Scofido plus Renfro, created a sustainable and accessible complex, the concept of which seems to take for its inspiration the physical feats of athletes, twisting and stretching centrifugally around the atrium space. You'll want to experience it for yourself, but Diller Scofido and Renfro has supplied a nice description on its website. Visitors ascend from the ground-level atrium to the top of the building quickly and gradually spiral down through a sequence of loft galleries, moving back and forth from the introspective atrium to the building's perimeter and views to the city and the mountains. The museum and the landscape are designed to form a new public plaza, nestling a distant view of Pikes Peak and an intersecting axis bridging downtown across the train tracks to the America the Beautiful Park to the west. In keeping with the Olympic and Paralympic ideals, the museum strives to deliver a shared experience for all visitors. Sports have the power to unite, Shield says, and that's what the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Museum has the ability to do. Real estate. Alpine Mountain Ranch and Club. CNI visits this fabulous new residential community just outside of Steamboat Springs, Colorado, by Wendy Wilkinson. The four-hour drive from Colorado Springs to Steamboat Springs was beautiful and relaxing. Wildflowers were still in full bloom in late August. Cattle grazed on green grasslands, and a snow-free view of the entire Yampa Valley unfolded before us as we descended over Rabbit Ears Pass on U.S. Route 40 and pulled into our destination, Alpine Mountain Ranch and Club. We were 10 minutes shy of the charming western-rooted resort town of Steamboat and a world away. Intrigued by the community's Dream It, Build It slogan, my husband and I had made the trip to check out the 5-acre home sites within the 1,200-acre ranch. We were in a dreamy mood, and the location certainly obliged. Bordering the charming ski resort, renowned for its world-class champagne powder and its setting fit for a Western film, the community ticked a lot of boxes for us, picturesque and pristine, accessible and amenity-rich. And there was plenty of water, a precious commodity frequently in short supply in many Colorado mountain communities. Alpine Mountain Ranch and Club boasts two fast-running streams, Priest Creek and Walton Creek, which border much of the ranch, and a stocked fishing lake at the base of the property. When we turned off the main road and entered the property, the lake greeted us and set the tone. Relaxation had already kicked in. But this was also a place where we could choose to be active. Our 2-day visit at Alpine Mountain Ranch and Club started with an authentic, bigger-than-Colorado steak ride dinner, where guests arrived to the meal on horseback. The dinner was supposed to be held at a favorite home site at the top of the ranch, but that plan changed with the unpredictable mountain weather. Storm clouds loomed on the horizon, but we mounted up at the owner's barn, more on that terrific place later. A dozen intrepid cowboys for the evening, we rode through a 250-acre hay meadow, up along a dense tree-lined trail, and into a high clearing for cocktails and light appetizers. The view was sweeter than the fresh mountain air. We inhaled deeply and judged it more intoxicating than the cowboy cosmos. After shuttling down to the owner's barn, we feasted on ranch hand-sized servings of locally sourced grilled ribeye and fresh salmon. A guitar-strumming, boot-wearing balladeer took requests around a crackling campfire. Although the evening was specially orchestrated for our group, it was the kind of expertise that defines the lifestyle of Alpine Mountain Ranch and Club, and it's a regular thing for owner residents. It was easy to imagine living here and celebrating special occasions, milestone birthdays, maybe our next anniversary like this. We toured the property to get a sense of the possibilities. The 63 5-acre lots are surrounded by 900 acres of non-buildable preserve land, so a feeling of complete privacy and tranquility permeated. Every building site offered an elevated viewing platform from which you could see the entire home site and what the land around it looked like. One home site invited as much dreaming as another. Some looked onto wide open ski area views, others onto the rolling greens of neighboring Catamount Golf Club. But my imagination went into overdrive, conjuring a future home on one of the home sites that was close to the horse-dotted pastures near the ranch entrance. For me, the closer to the horses, the better. We were never far from wildlife of all kinds. Throughout the property there were moose, bear, and elk, sometimes a herd of 100 or more, to keep eyes peeled for. The creatures roam freely through the property, retreating to more secluded areas dense with pine trees and other foliage. Touring two of the already built custom homes, Sunset Retreat, a mountain transitional style, and Moonlight Run, a mountain contemporary, I loved the dozens of windows in the living and great rooms, and their beautiful panoramic views of wide open spaces, rolling hills, and iconic landmarks like Southern Valley, the Flat Tops, and Emerald Mountain. We enjoyed a bit of sun at the owner's lodge next to the quaint lake, canoeing, stand-up paddleboarding, fishing, relaxing next to the water, exploring the preserve on the groomed trails. Residential ranch living never looked so appealing. And I hadn't even experienced one of the main attractions yet, gold medal fly fishing waters on the Yampa River, with private access just a mile and a half beyond the front gate. From the ski resort, we took the chairlift. Yes, it runs in the summer too, to see the surrounding countryside and Alpine Mountain Ranch and Club from above. Back down in the ski village, we spent some time at Alpine Mountain's private social club, Alpine Mountain Summit Club. Located within one steamboat's place, a 5-minute drive from the property, the club spoke to the skier in me. Ski in, ski out access, valet parking, heated lockers, ski valet, equipment storage, daily happy hour, breakfast, and generally just a comfortable and congenial atmosphere for congregating and hanging out. I could picture the skiing life here and the golfing life too. A short golf cart path away from the ranch, there was more social and sport potential in joining the Catamount Golf Club. There were miles of horseback riding and mountain biking trails for fair weather. When it snows, the trails are turned into a groomed cross-country skiing and snowshoe course, starting at the owner's barn and meandering through aspen groves to a hidden backcountry retreat called the Hermitage. At this small, inviting, rustic cabin nestled deep in the trees, there were Adirondack chairs on the front porch for kicking back in the summer, and a wood-burning stove inside for warming up in the winter. For me, the heart of the property was the owner's barn. It was like a standing invitation to a family picnic within sight of those wonderful horses and hillsides. I could practically feel the blanket on the ground and taste the Pinot Grigio, hummus, and goat cheese. On any given day, though, I'd rather ride. And what a place to do it. At the barn, I could borrow one of the 6 well-trained horses or stable my own horse in one of the wooden stalls. I could ask that my steed be saddled and bridled and waiting for me. But this lifelong cowgirl daydreamed of tacking up herself for a ride up the slope. I'd climb from 6,500 feet to the top of the ranch at almost 9,000 and survey what could be my own little piece of paradise. Dream it, build it. Yes, yes. Now, I just want to live it.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'll be reading a few short articles from True West magazine. This first article is from True West, June 2020 edition. Initiation to Robbery. June 24th, 1889 was a big day in the life and career of Robert Bob Leroy Parker. He and 2, maybe 3, accomplices dipped into big-time crime when they held up a bank in Telluride, Colorado. If the name Bob Parker doesn't sound familiar, then try this better-known alias, Butch Cassidy. Telluride made sense as the target of Butch's first stick-up. He moved to the town in 1884 when he was just 18, employed to haul ore down from the nearby mountains. During the winter months, he turned to cowboying in Wyoming and Utah. In 1887, Bob Butch made a new friend, a fellow Utah Mormon named Willard Christensen, going by the name of Matt Warner. The two partnered in a horse racing operation and made some significant cash, which they promptly blew in the saloons and other dens of inequity. Within a few months, they teamed up with Warner's brother-in-law, Tom McCarty. He had a long list of crimes to his name, including horse and cattle theft, and maybe a train holdup. In the early spring of 1889, the trio was dead broke and looking for a quick score. At the end of March, they may have extorted $21,000 from a Denver bank, although evidence linking them to the crime is anecdotal. But what is certain, the three turned their attention to Telluride that summer. The job was a classic, a blueprint that the Wild Bunch would follow many times in the years to come. Butch stayed in town for several weeks, casing the San Miguel Valley Bank. McCarty and Warner stayed some miles away, making other preparations, like making money bags for carrying the loot. All three of them were in Telluride on Saturday, June 22nd, 1889, hitting the bars and having a good time during the weekend. Witnesses said that 4 men rode into town that Monday. It's not clear who the fourth man was. Speculation centered on the Sundance Kid or Bob Parker's little brother Dan, although McCarty and Warner later denied there was another participant. One man entered the bank just after noon and threw down on the cashier, the only person in the bank. 2 other robbers came in to collect the money. The fourth may have been holding the horses outside. The outlaws then headed slowly out of town, seeking to avoid notice, until they got near the Telluride limits, when they began yelling, firing their pistols, and spurred their mounts. It's believed they got just over $20,000. The boys headed southwest toward Cortez, about 70 miles away. A posse trailed them, but the outlaws had set up a relay of horses to speed their trip. After losing the lawmen, the fugitives spent about a week near Cortez, then took a circuitous route to Browns Park in northwest Colorado, a trip of more than 400 miles. There, another posse caught wind of them. Butch and company headed to Robber's Roost in Utah, a 300-mile ride. Matt Warner later recounted that a small posse chased them into the roost. The lawmen were out of water and in danger of dying of thirst. The outlaws took them captive and made sure they got water before sending them on their way to civilization. According to Warner, he and Butch and McCarty made the local sheriff take his pants off, unsaddle his horse, and then ride the animal back home. The boys got quite a laugh out of that. Eventually, the boys ended up in Wyoming, around the hole in the wall. Butch was likely involved in livestock theft over the next few years. He also did 18 months in the state pen on a controversial charge of stealing a horse. But he didn't dive back into major crimes until August 13, 1896, when he joined with Elsie Lay, Bub Meeks, and Harvey Logan in robbing the bank at Montpelier, Idaho. The Wild Bunch was born. Mark Boardman is the features editor for True West Magazine, as well as the editor of this Tombstone Epitaph. He also serves as pastor for Poplar Grove United Methodist Church in Indiana. From True West, June 2020. Wild Bill shot down. August 2nd, 1876. Wild Bill Hickok walks from his camp on the edge of Deadwood to Lewis, Nuttall, and Mann's No. 10 Saloon. Entering around noon, he encounters about a half dozen men. Three men are playing draw poker. Wild Bill recognizes Missouri River Steamboat Captain William R. Massey and Charlie Henry Rich, a card dealer Wild Bill knows from his days in Cheyenne, Wyoming territory. Wild Bill joins their gang. Wild Bill sits in the only available seat, near the rear entrance of the saloon facing the front door. He usually sits along the west wall, but Rich is occupying that seat. Wild Bill prefers that seat's view of the entire room, including good views of the front and back doors, and asks Rich for his regular seat, but the gambler refuses to move. Wild Bill, uncomfortable with the fact that his back is exposed to the open bar and rear door, once again asks Rich to trade places. This time, the other players chide Wild Bill, telling him he has nothing to worry about this early in the day. Wild Bill takes the empty seat. The four men have been playing draw poker for almost 3 hours when Jack McCall, also known as Bill Sutherland, walks through the front door, heads over to the bar, pauses, moves down the bar, and stops momentarily at the scales sitting on the end of the bar. Wild Bill throws down his hand in disgust and says, "The old duffer, he broke me on that hand." McCall steps forward, takes out a pistol, and points it at the back of Wild Bill's head, pulling the trigger at the same instant. The bullet exits Wild Bill's right cheek near the bottom of his nose. His head moves slightly forward, and he is still for a moment. Then he falls sideways off his stool onto the floor. He dies instantly. A premonition of death. "I feel that my days are numbered. My sun is sinking fast. I know I shall be killed here. Something tells me I shall never leave these hills alive. Somebody is going to kill me, but I don't know who it is or why he is going to do it." Wild Bill said these words to a friend a week before his death. The Cheyenne Daily Leader reports the account weeks later on August 26, 1876. Wild Bill admitted his fears to his wife Agnes in a letter postmarked August 1st, the day before he was killed. "Agnes, darling, if such should be we never meet again, while firing my last shot, I will gently breathe the name of my wife, Agnes, and with wishes,
even for my enemies, I will make the plunge and try to swim to the other shore. The Reverend W.F. Warren surely must have misread the marriage ceremony. So much for not meaning it. Aftermath, odds and ends. The death bullet fired by Jack McCall passes through Wild Bill and hits William R. Massey in his left arm above the wrist. The riverboat captain thinks Hickok, perhaps enraged over losing, has shot him. Backing towards the rear door, McCall screams at everyone, "Come on, ye sons of bitches!" He cocks his pistol and fires, but the gun fails to shoot. He then tries to fire again at the bartender, who has come out from behind the bar to help Wild Bill, but the gun misfires again. McCall flees. Captured and tried the next day, on August 3, 1876, in the new Deadwood Theater, McCall testifies Wild Bill shot his brother in Kansas 2 years earlier, and that the killing is an act of vengeance. Although completely false, the jury of minors finds him not guilty. On August 3rd, Colorado Charlie Utter holds a funeral service for Wild Bill and pays for a burial plot and marker. McCall leaves town for Lorain City, Wyoming Territory, where he brags about the killing. Colonel George Mays obtains a federal arrest warrant and takes McCall into custody on August 29th. Tried in federal court in December 1876, McCall admits he lied about Wild Bill killing his brother. He is found guilty and hanged on March 1, 1877. His body is buried with the hangman's noose still around his neck in an unmarked grave in the local Catholic cemetery. Recommended. The Illustrated Life and Times of Wild Bill Hickok by Bob Bowes Bell, 2017, published by Two Roads West. Here's an article from True West, February-March 2020 edition. Black Kettle, The People's Peacemaker, by Lewis Craft. Hoping to end the 1867 Plains War, over 5,000 Indians camped on the Medicine Lodge Peace Council grounds in Kansas on October 14, 1867, but only Black Kettle's band of Cheyennes were present. The rest of the tribe had assembled on the Cimarron River in Indian Territory, where Keeper of the Sacred Arrows, Stone Forehead, would renew them. 3 days later, Black Kettle attempted an impromptu meeting with the commissioners. His attitude wasn't the best. "We were once friends with the whites," he said, "but you nudged us out of the way by your intrigues." He wanted them to stop pushing each other. "Why don't you talk and go straight and let all be well?" Later that day, the Cheyenne dogmen, dog soldiers is a white man term, chiefs Tall Bull and Grayhead visited the council grounds. Before leaving, Tall Bill confronted Black Kettle in his camp. He wanted to know why he wasn't on the Cimarron River to participate in the renewal of the arrows. He told Black Kettle to travel to the Cimarron and tell the called-out people what good another treaty with the white man would bring. When Black Kettle refused, Tall Bull threatened to kill his horse herd. He also warned him not to speak. When the negotiations officially began on October 19th, Black Kettle remained silent. 3 days later, dog men returned to the council grounds in a downpour. They woke Black Kettle and forced him to ride to the peace commissioner's camp. While they waited for the white men to dress, Black Kettle became livid when he argued with Little Robe. No interpreters were present, but an unnamed reporter viewed it and later wrote, "Being a peacemaker among the Cheyennes in 1867 was a dangerous occupation." Senator John Henderson appeared and demanded that the Cheyennes attend council. Tempers flared, but Black Kettle stepped between the dogmen and Henderson and ended the confrontation. Before departing, the dogmen forced Black Kettle to ride to the Cimarron with them. The chief's abduction upset the peace commissioners and reporters. Most feared a Cheyenne attack. the Kiowas and Comanches signed their treaty on October 21st. Finally, on October 27th, Cheyenne and Dogmen burst from the trees and rode across the creek as they shouted and fired their weapons. Black Kettle rode near the head of the charge. He was disheveled, but alive. It wasn't an attack. The Cheyennes were ready to hear the white man's words. The Cheyenne and Arapaho Council began the next day. But again, Black Kettle was advised to remain silent. Only Dogman, Chief Buffalo Chief, spoke. "We do not claim this country south of the Arkansas, but that country between the Arkansas and the Platte is ours. You give us presents and then take our land. That produces war." The commissioners ignored Buffalo Chief. There was total silence. The Cheyenne leaders realized that the white men were done talking and began to walk away. Interpreter John Smith saved the day by getting them to listen to Henderson. He told them that they could roam throughout the unsettled portions of the country they claim as originally theirs, which lies between the Arkansas and Platte Rivers, to hunt buffalo. Henderson didn't lie, but the treaty was never read to the Indians, and the U.S. government ignored his promise. Instead, the treaty would proclaim that the Cheyennes retained their right to hunt buffalo on their former land south of the Arkansas. The winter of 1867-68 had been harsh, but the spring would be worse. In March, when Major General Philip Sheridan, who commanded the Division of the Missouri, blocked the issuing of weapons with the annuity distribution, Black Kettle and other chiefs didn't hide their anger. It happened again in April, but Black Kettle didn't complain as the Cheyennes were in a state of starvation. During the May distribution, Black Kettle and Stone Forehead complained to Agent Ned Wincoop about not receiving the promised weapons, but accepted the supplies. Not so at the July 20th distribution, for as soon as Black Kettle and the other chiefs saw that they would not receive weapons, they stopped the process. "Our white brothers are pulling away from us the hand they had given to us at Medicine Lodge Creek," an angry Black Kettle said. He refused the shipment, while making it clear he would wait with patience for the Great Father to deliver the promised arms and ammunition. Realizing the urgency, Wincoop petitioned to have the arms released and received permission, providing that no evil will result from such a delivery. On August 9th, Black Kettle and other chiefs camped near Wincoop's Fort Larned Agency and agreed not to use the weapons on whites. The agent distributed the previously refused supplies and the guns. Black Kettle and the others were thrilled. That same day, Lieutenant General William T. Sherman created a military district for the Cheyenne, Arapahoes, Comanches, and Kiowas in Indian Territory that Lieutenant Colonel William Hazen would command. But on August 10th, an intended Cheyenne-led raid on the Pawnees in Nebraska that began on August 2nd, morphed into days of rape, destruction, and death to white homesteaders on the Saline and Solomon Rivers in Kansas. When Black Kettle, who was still camped near Fort Larned, heard what happened, he yanked his hair and ripped his clothing. Seeing the chief's distress, Wincoop told him if he moved to Fort Larned, he would take care of him. Black Kettle refused the offer. In mid-November 1864, the military had promised the Cheyennes protection if they moved to Sand Creek, but that resulted in a massacre of the people on the 29th. Although he intended to move on to the Buffalo's migratory path, Black Kettle decided to get his band as far away from the white man as possible and moved south with his followers into Indian Territory. His destination was Washita River. The chief's gut reaction to the future was on target. On September 17th, Lieutenant General Sherman declared war on the Cheyennes. There would be no more excuses, no more treaties, for this war would end the Cheyennes' freedom on the central and southern plains. Moons passed. Black Kettle learned that the white soldiers hunted the people south of the Arkansas. He also heard of a white peace chief at Fort Cobb, 119 miles east of his Washita village. Braving a bitter winter storm, he and others rode to meet Colonel William Hazen. On November 20th, Black Kettle said to Hazen, "I have always done my best to keep my young men quiet, but some will not listen. And since the fighting began, I have not been able to keep all of them at home." But this was nothing new, and had been said to the white man time and again. Contrary to false statements, Black Kettle didn't attempt to ransom captives for peace, for he had none. Hazen sounded sincere, but he wasn't open to Black Kettle moving to the safe zone that he commanded for Indians supposedly not involved in the current war. 2 days later, Hazen reported to Sherman, "To have made peace with Black Kettle would have brought to my camp most of those now on the warpath south of the Arkansas." Black Kettle wasn't on the warpath. Nothing had changed, absolutely nothing. For Black Kettle was considered the chief of all the Cheyennes, and this made him the foremost war leader. The evening of the 26th was freezing. Nevertheless, Black Kettle met in council with chiefs in his village. They undoubtedly discussed what they should do. It didn't matter. At dawn, white soldiers yelled as they charged into the village and fired their weapons. Women and children screamed in fright. The hell of Sand Creek, 4 years previous, had again become reality. Black Kettle mounted a horse tethered to his lodge, pulled his wife, medicine woman later, up behind him, and attempted to escape across the Washita. A minute later, maybe two, soldiers' bullets ended their lives. Lieutenant Colonel Custer and the 7th U.S. Cavalry had attacked the village without knowing its occupants. He would report that he killed 101 warriors, including Black Kettle, as well as some women and children. But Custer's death count is questionable, and will forever be so. For two mixed-blood Arapahoes, Jack Fitzpatrick and John Hoysel Jr., who served under him, disagreed. They claimed that Custer exaggerated, that there was not over 20 bucks killed. The rest, about 40, were women and children. Former Agent Wincoop received Fitzpatrick and Hoysel Jr.'s statement. When invited to speak at the Cooper Institute in New York City in December 1868, he had this to say about Black Kettle. "The whole force of his nature was concentrated in the one idea of how to best act for the good of his race." Regardless of how the called-out people viewed him, from the time that he became a chief in 1855 until his death, Black Kettle worked to prevent or end war between the races. From True West, February-March 2020. "I Will Fight No More Forever" by Candy Moulton. Fighting that broke out at Whitebird Canyon in Idaho in June of 1877 between the Nez Perce Indians and the U.S. Army, commanded by Major General Oliver O. Howard, had continued through the summer with engagements along the Clearwater River and at Camas Meadows in Idaho and the Big Hole in western Montana. By August, the Nez Perce people had outpaced the army as they struck the Madison River and followed it into Yellowstone National Park. Few expected the Nez Perce, with Chief Joseph and the other Nez Perce headmen, to enter the park, but they had already proven that they would take a different route than expected. As the main party moved slowly along the river, Yellow Wolf and fellow scouts took several tourists. George and Emma Cowan and her sister and brother, Frank and Ida Carpenter, as captives. Yellow Wolf instructed the tourists to turn east, travel along a stream, later called Nez Perce Creek, and follow a barely discernible trail through a pine forest to Mary Lake. Lean Elk, still responsible for the Nez Perce March, kept an eye on the captives and restrained younger warriors who still sought revenge for the attack on their families at the Big Hole. On the way up the trail toward Mary Lake, Lean Elk told the Cowans they could leave. Men in their party escaped into the woods, while Emma and her family backtracked until younger warriors surrounded them, shot George Cowan in the leg and then in the head, and threatened the others. Lean Elk and a Nez Perce named Red Scout had followed the tourists to see to their safety, came upon the attack and stopped the young warriors from further harming the tourists. With Red Scout's help, Lean Elk took Emma Cowan and Frank and Ida Carpenter back into custody, leaving George Cowan, who was presumed dead, beside the trail. The Indians and captives continued to cross Yellowstone Park and into the open meadowland of the Hayden Valley before following the Yellowstone River upstream to Mud Volcano. There, the stench of sulfur mixed with the burping, bubbling sounds of superheated, boiling mud stung their noses as they plunged their horses across the river. At Pelican Valley, in the southeastern part of the park, the Indians halted for the day, building fires for each family camp while women fished for supper. During the evening, Nez Perce warriors and headmen joined Chief Joseph and Lean Elk in council near the fire. Emma and her siblings could not understand what was being said, but knew at least part of the discussion involved their fate, with Joseph arguing on their behalf. The following morning, Lean Elk took the captives, gave them two horses to ride, helped them cross the Yellowstone River, showed them a trail, and told them to go quick. They made their way steadily but cautiously until they met a military scouting party and provided information on the location of the Nez Perce camp, the Indians' direction of travel, and the condition of the people and their animals. As they had intended from the onset, the Nez Perces and their families now turned toward Crow Indian lands, following Pelican Valley, a broad 10-mile-long area. While in Yellowstone, the Indians traveled shorter distances each day, resting and recovering from what had already been a grueling trip. They separated into two major groups, one led by Joseph, the other commanded by Looking Glass, as they followed different drainages to Mist Creek Pass, and then all descended to the Lamar River on the eastern side of Yellowstone Park. Joseph led his followers north along the Lamar, abandoning dozens of horses and mules that had been cut and injured as they negotiated the rugged terrain. Eventually, they turned east, traveling out of Yellowstone. General Howard followed the Madison River into Yellowstone Park days after Joseph and the Nez Perces wove their way there and captured the tourists. Howard's command, with its wagons for support, moved slower than the Nez Perces or the general's own scouts. Howard's party found George Cowan, not dead, but seriously injured, and placed him in one of the wagons. On September 4th, Howard's force reached Mud Volcano and the Yellowstone River ford the Nez Perces had used. He ordered the men to bathe and wash clothing in the hot mineral springs. The wagons had stopped after their difficult descent to the Yellowstone River, and the following day, Howard discharged the Teamsters, telling them to make their way out of the park. The soldiers now used pack mules to carry supplies. Howard himself abandoned the trail of the Nez Perces at the ford near Mud Volcano, following the Yellowstone downstream before riding east, intending to close in on the Indians and corner them. He knew from messages received while he was in Yellowstone that Lieutenant Colonel Samuel D. Sturgis, with 450 mounted men of the 7th Cavalry and several Crow Indian scouts, had moved into the Shoshone River country just east of Yellowstone. This force was poised to encounter the Nez Perces as they left the park, but before they could cross onto the open plains of Montana's buffalo country. Sturgis, a Pennsylvanian, was an experienced Indian fighter, having engaged Jisarilla Apaches in the 1850s and Kiowas and Comanches on the southern plains in the 1860s. Joseph and the other headmen recombined their parties in Sunlight Basin, a big hole ringed by mountains just east of Yellowstone. To move out of it, they could cross over the steep mountains, forming part of the Absaroka Range, or they could venture near the narrow defile of Clark's Fork River. This canyon was as rugged and seemingly impenetrable as those in the upper reaches of the Snake River near Joseph's Walloa homeland. To the dismay of Sturgis and Howard, the headmen chose the river route, and on September 8th, again, gave the army the slip. The Nez Perces exited Clark's Fork and headed north back into Montana, with Lean Elk still in charge of the daily travel. The Crows would not help them, and since they could not remain in the buffalo country along the Yellowstone River as intended, they revised their plans. They would travel another 300 or more miles to Canada and join Sitting Bull, the Hunkpapa leader who had escaped there after the June 1876 battle at the Little Bighorn. The 13 days the Nez Perces spent crossing through Yellowstone, while giving them a chance to rest and recuperate, allowed the military ample opportunity to get into position. Sturgis, though thwarted in his first effort to stop them as they departed the park, remained in striking distance, and Howard still pushed from behind. There were now hundreds of troops surrounding the Indians, closing in to check their flight. We could have escaped. What started as an obscure Army versus Indian campaign in a remote mountain valley in Idaho became a national drama that summer of 1877. At first, regional newspaper correspondents like Thomas Sutherland of the Portland Daily Standard and writers for the Owyhee Avalanche and Lewiston Teller in Idaho kept the public apprised of the events. But the capture of tourists at Yellowstone brought increased newspaper attention to Joseph and his people. By the time the Nez Perces emerged from the park, the story of their Hegira was headlined all across America. The success of the Nez Perces in the engagements in Idaho and western Montana, and the embarrassing fact that a few hundred Indians and their families, with a couple of thousand head of horses, had eluded an ever-growing army force, began to draw not only attention, but also empathy from people following the story, and in some cases, from the very troops who pursued them. I am actually beginning to admire their bravery and endurance in the face of so many well-equipped enemies, Howard's field surgeon, Dr. John Fitzgerald, said. Such was not the view, however, of the Army's supreme commander, General William T. Sherman, who barely missed running headlong into the Indians during his tour of Yellowstone Park in August. He suggested harsh action. Their horses, arms, and property should be taken away. Many of their leaders should be executed, he said. Sherman, like other military commanders, believed that most of the tribesmen will fight hard, skillfully, to the death. Now out of Yellowstone, the tribal members had a skirmish with troops from the 6th and 7th Cavalry commanded by Sturgis at Canyon Creek, but kept to their trail north toward Canada. There was now another effort to stop them. General Howard, plagued by weary men and horses and suffering from limited supplies after following the Indians across rough lands impossible for wagons, asked Colonel Nelson Miles, commander of the cantonment on the Tongue River in eastern Montana, to make every effort in your power to prevent the escape of this hostile band, and at least to hold them in check until I can overtake them. A 38-year-old career soldier from Massachusetts, Miles took to the field against the Nez Perces on September 18th, just over 3 months since their flight began. Miles was intimately familiar with the country the Nez Perces were then crossing. During the recent winter campaign, Miles had pursued Sitting Bull into Canada and still monitored the Hunk Papa Medicine Man's band. The Nez Perces were just 80 miles from the Canadian border when Looking Glass again assumed primary leadership for them, replacing Lean Elk. Almost immediately, the travel pace slowed, but they traveled another 40 miles. They camped on Snake Creek at the edge of the Bear Paw Mountains at noon on September 29. Later that day, General Miles and his 500 troops could see the Bear Paw Mountains when it began raining and then a light snow started. Late that afternoon, scouts riding for Miles returned to the main column to report that they had located the Nez Perce Trail and knew the camp was nearby. Chief Joseph and his daughter, Sound of Running Water, were at the horses' herds early on the morning of September 30th, preparing to break camp when they heard the cry, "Soldiers, soldiers, soldiers," as Cheyenne Indian scouts and 7th Cavalry troopers broke over the ridge and swept toward the Nez Perce camp. "We had no knowledge of General Miles's army until a short time before he charged upon us, cutting our camp in two and capturing nearly all of our horses," Joseph said. The cold morning erupted into chaos. Miles's troopers attacked with a vengeance. Yellow Wolf watched hundreds of soldiers charging in two wide circling wings. They were surrounding our camp. "I called my men to drive them back. We fought at close range, not more than 20 steps apart," Joseph said. Some soldiers fell in the Indian camp, and the Nez Perces took their guns and ammunition as they repulsed three separate onslaughts by the troopers. The day ended in misery for both sides. Dozens of Miles's troops had been killed or wounded. Several of the Nez Perce leaders also had been killed, including leaders Olokot, Lean Elk, and Tulholholzote. Indian families were divided as some members fled toward Canada, while others were surrounded by troops and under attack. In their camp, the Nez Perces faced tough decisions. "We could have escaped from Bear Paw Mountain if we had left our wounded, old women, and children behind," Joseph said. "We were unwilling to do this." The Battle of Bear Paw became a siege. Over the next 4 days, Joseph met directly with Miles. He was held in the soldier camp against his will, but at the same time, soldiers were captured by the Indians. After tense negotiations, Joseph was allowed to return to his camp, and the soldiers were released as well. Back in the Indian camp, Joseph met with White Bird and Looking Glass. Before any final decision was made, a military sharpshooter killed Looking Glass. This left White Bird and Chief Joseph to lead the Nez Perces. In the end, they agreed to follow their own paths. Chief Joseph said, "I could not bear to see my wounded men and women suffer any longer. We had lost enough already. My people needed rest. We wanted peace." He continued, "The little children are freezing to death. My people, some of them, have run away to the hills and have no blankets, no food. No one knows where they are, perhaps freezing to death. I want to have time to look for my children and see how many of them I can find. Maybe I shall find them among the dead. Hear me, my chiefs. I am tired. My heart is sick and sad. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever." Joseph's surrender speech became the defining statement of his life and his people. According to Joseph, Miles had promised that we might return to our country with what stock we had left. "I thought we could start again. I believed him, or I never would have surrendered." The night of Joseph's surrender, White Bird and tribal members who followed him escaped and fled to Canada. of the 700 souls who had camped along Snake Creek near the Bear Paw Mountains at noon on September 29, 1877, Miles eventually held 448 as prisoners of war. 25 had died on the battlefield, and the remainder reached Canada. This article is an excerpt from Chief Joseph, Guardian of the People, the Spur Award-winning biography by Candy Moulton. Here's an article from True West's June 2020 edition, The West Awaits, by Stuart Rosebrook. The Great Western American Road Trip is a bucket list for travelers all over the world. During this worldwide COVID-19 pandemic, we know that travel is limited at best and non-existent at worst. Although the nation awaits the lifting of travel restrictions and the slow reopening of each state, including parks, historic attractions, museums, hotels, restaurants, and bars, True West's editorial team offers four distinct scenic heritage trips across the western United States to inspire your future travel. We hope to capture your imagination and encourage you to plan a road trip to discover the Old West in a way you've never discovered before. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip to one of the routes that they are suggesting. The Southern Route West, Fort Smith to El Paso. In 1858, 2 years before the opening of the Northern Route of the Pony Express, the first national overland mail service was established on a southern route from St. Louis and Memphis to San Francisco. Soon known as the Butterfield Overland Mail Route, a major juncture of the two northern trunk lines met in Fort Smith, Arkansas, before the stages ventured across the border into the Indian Territory and the wilds of frontier Texas. In 1858, the Comanches still ruled much of the southern plains, and the stagecoach mail service's long ramble across the Lone Star State was protected by small companies of Texas Rangers and a series of Army infantry and mounted dragoon companies stationed in a long arc to El Paso. Today, the intrepid heritage traveler can enjoy a long, slow ride from Arkansas across southeastern Oklahoma and Texas to El Paso, with numerous historic sites, parks, and restored frontier forts to tarry at along the way. And of course, they'll enjoy lots of good regional Texas barbecue and Mexican food on the route. Mileage, 1,030 miles. Time, minimum a week, but 2 weeks would allow time to tour historic forts, museums, and appreciate great barbecue and Mexican food. Bucket list, Arkansas, Fort Smith. Book a room at the 1817 Historic Inn in the Fort Smith Bell Grove Historic District, and spend a few days exploring one of the oldest American cities west of the Mississippi. Don't miss the Bass Reeves statue, dedicated to the famous black deputy U.S. Marshal, and spend a day or two touring the Fort Smith National Historic Site, including the barracks and Judge Isaac Parker's famous courtroom. A new attraction should open in the city in the fall, the U.S. Marshal Museum. Oklahoma, Fort Washita. Built in 1842 as the southernmost American outpost before Texas was a state, the fort near Colbert's Ferry protected travelers along the national trail and mail route. Today, the Chickasaw Nation maintains the historic site. Texas, Sherman. The East Texas outpost was 205 miles from Fort Smith and a welcome sight for weary travelers. Take time to visit the Sherman Museum and the Texas Historical Marker near the site of the original stage station. Fort Belknap. Built in 1851 and rebuilt near its original foundations in the 1930s, the fort is maintained as a museum near Newcastle. The isolated Army base was home to the 2nd Cavalry when the stage line was in operation between 1858 and 1861. Fort Chadburn, The Army opened the post in 1852 to protect travelers and citizens living on the Texas frontier, and it operated as a station for the Butterfield Overland Mail Company. Today, the fort is a Texas State Historical Site with a visitor center, museum, and six restored buildings. Fort Stockton, established in the spring of 1859, adjacent to Comanche Springs, Fort Stockton became a key post on the southern plains of West Texas. Modern Fort Stockton is a great spot to stay for a long weekend and immerse in the local history. Schedule time to tour the historic Fort Stockton, the Annie Riggs Memorial Museum, and the Mesa Vineyard and Tasting Room. Fort Davis. Fort Davis National Historic Site is the best preserved Texas frontier fort in the Lone Star State and offers living history events throughout the year. Stay at the Hotel Olympia and explore the area, including the towns of Pecos and Fort Stockton. Big Bend National Park. Take a side trip via Alpine to one of America's treasures, Big Bend National Park. Book a room at the historic Chizos